Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unifowaken.
This week, streaming video will beat Blu-rays by 2015, Google boosts their maps while Apple's maps team sweats, Vodafone admits its users are being snooped on, a chatbot has fooled humans for the first time ever, perhaps, and all the latest from the Electronic Entertainment Expo. As always, you can check out the past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you do that, please leave us a review. Leave us a review on our show notes. Write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Let's just jump in right into our headlines here and talk about our hot stories of the week. We talked about net neutrality for the past few episodes, and we've talked about FCC's loosening of its net neutrality standards in favor of what cable providers and the big ISPs would rather have in that place.
Which is pay to play.
Yeah. And Vice magazine believes that the nation's cable companies are funding groups that pretend to represent consumers, but are actually just parroting their own stance to shout down the general public in comments to the FCC about the net neutrality issue. The FCC opened up
public comment.
The public has been shutting down the FCC's site, flooding them with comments about how it desperately wants net neutrality. They've actually broken the website, but there have been groups of other users that are mimicking the stance that the cable companies want. And Vice magazine believes that there's astroturfing going on.
Yeah, so astroturfing is basically what happens when wealthy special interests spend money to create what appears to be a grassroots movement. AstroTurf is fake grass, that kind of thing. What's really interesting here is that there's no economic incentive for users to ever want there to be a lack of net neutrality. Like, no user has ever said, man, I really wish Netflix had to pay more for Fastlane on the internet.
Right.
Right? Like, no user has ever said that, because there's no incentive there. People respond to incentives, and there's no incentive for In fact, it's a counter-incentive, because if Netflix has to pay more to get their data from the edge of the internet across Comcast network to your house, which you're already paying for as a Comcast customer, then in that case, Netflix is going to pass the cost on to you. If Netflix has to pay Comcast, then Netflix is going to charge you. It's going to pass those costs on because it needs to maintain its profit margin. So the very idea that the FCC would actually, like, you know, obviously then FCC is not sitting around trying to figure out who's sending what comments, but the very idea that the FCC would entertain the consumer saying, "Yeah, I need this net neutrality to go away," is ridiculous. So it's kind of, I don't know. Like,
Vice did a little research, and they discovered that one group called Broadband for America, which describes itself as a coalition involving independent consumer advocacy groups, is actually funded by the NCTA, which are the lobbyists for big cable. And another group called
the Koch brothers on media.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. And another group, the American Consumer Institute, another anti-net neutrality voice of the people, receives the bulk of its funding from the CTIA, which represents U.S. wireless interests.
Yeah, I'd be really interested to hear their full-on justification of why they are behind.
Because consumer advocates everywhere are demanding that the Federal Communications Commission continue its current path for shelving net neutrality and allowing a two-tiered internet. That's their line.
That's their one line. But can they speak in depth about it?
Yeah. I mean, the Vice article has some stuff. People should check it out. But as the headline goes, this is just – it's just such transparent corporate bullshit and things people fall for, and that sucks. Or the FCC wants to fall for it because they're going to be – they're going to point to this and say, well, other people have said this. That kind of thing.
Yeah, let's hope that's not the case. Let's hope they're smarter than that.
They're run by a guy who was a cable – a big cable, like, builder. The guy who runs the FCC is a cable – is a cable insider. So it's not clear that he has a neutral, for lack of a better term, perspective on this. He's got buddies in the cable industry. He's got buddies in Comcast and Time Warner and these places. Right. So,
and that's one of the discussions we had probably maybe even a year ago when he first was given that position. It was like, well, why? You know, it didn't make much sense.
This country with all these insiders. Oh, I was on the you know, I was on the inside. I'm Ben Bernanke. I was working for the government for a while. And now that I'm not working for the government anymore and I've bailed out all the banks, I can go around and get paid $200,000 to speak at any bank. And that's how I get payback. Like, it's ridiculous how people just move from the private sector to the public sector like this.
Yep. Speaking of oddities in the wireless industry, Vodafone, one of the world's largest mobile phone groups, has revealed the existence of secret wires that allow government agencies to listen to all conversations on its networks, saying they're widely used in some of the 29 countries in which it operates in Europe and beyond. They've broken silence on this in order to push back against the increasingly widespread use of phone and broadband networks to spy on citizens. They said that the wires had been connected directly to its network and those of other telecom groups, allowing agencies to listen to or record live conversations, and in certain cases, track the whereabouts of a customer.
Yeah, it's funny because you think of Vodafone as a wireless company, and here they're installing wires to help the government listen in on, like, dedicated hard lines, like Matrix style.
I guess I appreciate their honesty after the fact, but it's...
Well, I think the political climate is in a place where they can say it when, you know, like, and they're less afraid of whatever ramifications the government might give them because they'll probably get consumers standing up for them in this case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, this is one of those. It's one of those big risks. I mean, do you risk it all by being upfront and honest with your consumers and being and giving them a mea culpa, or you also risk people not, you know, losing trust?
Yeah, so. It's crazy. It's crazy. The company said that wires had been connected directly to its network and those of other telecom groups, allowing agencies to listen or to record live conversations, and in certain cases, track the whereabouts of a customer.
Yeah.
You know?
Creepy.
It's a nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so this is probably one of my most interesting stories of this week, and that is, according to a report by PricewaterhouseCoopers, box office and digital revenue, meaning... box office and digital revenue will climb steadily over the next 5 years, but rentals and sales of DVDs and other discs will fall sharply. Basically, what this means is that downloading and streaming video is going to beat physical home video by 2016. That is Blu-rays and DVDs.
I mean, that makes sense.
It does.
It's better for... You know, DVDs have a pretty big margin and everything, but in the end, it's better for the companies, right? Because the companies that produce the content, they have far more control if people are streaming the stuff than people are buying a Blu-ray, putting it in a computer, and, like, you know, pulling it out there. I think, especially with this whole ultraviolet thing, they've proven that people will try it, even though ultraviolet is not the best experience and people complained about it. The idea of getting a digital copy when you get physical media has sold, and that's a gateway into just the digital media. Yeah. What's going to be interesting is how they deal with the current platform wars, right? Apple on the one hand, or Amazon or Google Play on the other two, on like another hand and a foot, so to speak. These companies would rather have people go directly to them and purchase the movies or stream the movies from, you know, Paramount.com or whatever. But people like to go shopping in a one-stop shop, and people don't actually think about who makes what movie. So it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that level of access.
I think what's interesting to me about this is that we've seen this foreshadowed in streaming music. We've already seen a similar reports earlier this year about how streaming music is overtaking downloading MP3s and other...
Yeah, peak MP3 has happened already mm-hmm. on the App Store, apparently. I mean, really, what it comes down to is storage, right? Like physical and digital storage. When Apple created the Apple TV in its current incarnation, Steve Jobs actually said, we didn't want you to have to think about storage or managing storage. And that's a big piece of an appliance. It's one of the most annoying things on a DVR or a TiVo when you're sitting there and it's like, oh, we couldn't record your show because we ran out of storage. So being able to stream it from the net is a big thing. I think one of the reasons why video didn't has never really hit it on the same level as audio is because video is a big fat file. It's a lot of bandwidth to stream these things. Like that's this whole net neutrality thing. So now that digital broadband is becoming even more ubiquitous, I can see 2016 being a place where on the regular it's an easy way, you know, it's the way that people are going to get their content. And it's a dangerous kind of thing too on some level because we've all joked about the fact that the Star Wars movies have been changed time and again and time and again. If you're getting your digital content from Disney and there was some Easter egg in there and Disney didn't find it appropriate, the next time you play that movie, it's not going to have it, right? So,
It's possible.
The idea of like the right to be forgotten when it comes to content publishers and their content, the right to change it up, the right to mix it up, all those things are there. Even right now, Netflix, there's a whole website dedicated to how different movies are when you watch them on Netflix than if you own the DVD or the Blu-ray. Because they do cut some things out or like make them shorter or whatever. So this is going to be an interesting phenomenon. But I mean,
rewriting history.
Yeah. Yeah, the convenience is just there for everybody. The idea that you can stream without thinking about it.
I agree. I think most consumers will take the path of least resistance. And I think you see that in all sorts of markets, right? In the cloud being one of the things that infiltrates enterprises as well as other workplaces, as well as, you know, music and other sorts of entertainment. So if the easiest way for me to get my content is to go through Netflix and stream it live, I'll do so, you know, rather than going out and having to dig around for DVDs or Blu-rays, right? To a certain extent.
Because storage prices have gone up. If you think about it, in the last 5-6 years, as flash storage has become the norm on both mobile and desktop devices, you used to be able to get, you know, a terabyte for like $60. Now a terabyte's like several hundred dollars. You know what I mean? So storing those downloaded MP3s are a problem. Storing those downloaded movies are a problem. You only need enough space to store one or two films if you're going to be in a long flight. But other than that, you're getting all your stuff from Wi-Fi or 3G.
Yeah, I think it's. I think part of that is also because the quality has also gone up. The space allocation that's been given has improved, but not to the same pace, right?
So, yeah, it's just the speed of flash is what you're paying for. Again, convenience over whatever. I mean, I guess we all remember when the iPod Mini first came out. It was cool because it was so small, but only had 4 gigs of space compared to the 20 you got on the normal iPod. People bought it, and then people bought the Nano because it was just so tiny, and that's what people want, and that's why Apple's dropping the price of iCloud to $47.99 or $48 for 200 gigabytes of cloud storage. That's huge.
Yeah. So, but I am still one of those people who watches my Blu-ray. So I still get those.
A collector is going to be a collector. You can't just collect. Yeah. You can't just collect digital stuff. Yeah,
I was going to say something similar. Like I have to agree with you. Like I was resistant at first with music. And now I'm fully on board. Like I fully embrace streaming. I have a Spotify premium account. I love it. I listen to more music that way than I would have with the 400 or so CDs that sit on a shelf in my house. However, I can't say that I have am ready to make that same switch over with video because I actually notice a difference between the compression in streaming video and
what's on a Blu-ray
and what's on a Blu-ray.
Yeah, although Netflix is working on rolling out 4K streaming video, which would beat a Blu-ray. I mean, part of it is, does the industry want to look to Sony or some other manufacturer to create a Blu-ray, like some sort of like 4K Blu-ray Ultra HD disc, which costs a lot of money to research and figure out, and there's a format war and all that crap. Or do you want there to be a standard that allows people to push their digital media across the internet and into, you know, your face with that 4K quality right then and right there. It's also dynamic quality. One of the big issues we've had is, you know, people basically back in the day, the Apple TV 2 came out and it was 720p, and then Apple TV 3 came out, it was 1080p, and everything just got upgraded. If it was HD, it was HD, it was HD. Meanwhile, in the old school way, you bought Moonstruck on VHS, then you bought Moonstruck on DVD, then you bought Moonstruck on Blu-ray. I don't know if you guys are watching Moonstruck, but that's like a thing. So
the bottom line
this
is
this is saving some of that. I think that there's going to be a break between what's considered HD and Ultra HD. And they'll have to come out with Super Ultra HD or whatever. But 8K. I think for the most part, you can buy something and the quality is going to be pretty damn good for, you know, a generation or two.
Yeah, I may not have a choice for much longer to stick with the physical format because, as you've discussed, there is no current 4K standard for physical media, and there probably won't be.
Yeah, so. I mean, and they just have so much more control. So I can see this being this is just the future. Just you're going to stream your stuff. The only problem is if you're Spotify and you get in a fight with Universal Music Group, you might suddenly find that music that you've liked on Spotify, that you put in a list, is no longer available to you. You don't have control anymore. That's one of the things about owning your own stuff.
Yeah.
Then there's the fact that, you know, you hit retirement, your income level drops, you're on a fixed income. And I'm not saying that, I'm not saying that, you know, you're going to run out of money and not be able to afford your Spotify account, but that's one of those things that you'll let go if things get tight.
Yep.
And then you won't have access to any of that stuff anymore.
You are absolutely right about that.
So, I mean, that's a gamble that the user's going to have to take in terms of what they're doing. I have a feeling that you can spend $10 a month on new music that you can keep, mm-hmm. and you'd be pretty happy about your collection of music.
Yeah.
If you were on the Apple or Amazon stores or Google Play stores and you bought 10 songs every month, you know, you thought about it, but the problem is you got to think about it.
Yeah.
And time is valuable.
Okay, moving on here. Last week we talked about the details of Apple's WWDC conference, and what wasn't mentioned during that conference was anything physical, any wearables. But Nikkei Asian Review is claiming that Apple's new watch-like wearable gear is coming in October, and it's going to run. It's going to be equipped with a centralized function to manage users' biometric information via their smartphone. It will likely use a curved organic light-emitting diode touchscreen and collect health-related data such as calorie consumption, sleep activity, blood glucose, and blood oxygen levels.
How's it going to tell calorie consumption without you telling it what calorie consumption
is? You might have to type in something. You might have to import in information.
If only there was a way. That would be so awesome.
What?
That if calorie consumption could be tracked without you having to enter in that information.
What they need to do is make, like, for instance, the Fitbit app has calorie consumption tie-ins. A lot of the food that you eat, it's your, you know, people aren't always cooking these days. And a lot of food that you eat is packaged or at a restaurant. There's no reason why they can't work with the industry to make a barcode reader on there. You blip your shit.
Oh, that's true.
I don't know. I, for lunch, I tend to eat like Amy's organic frozen lunches or whatever. It's all my salt for the day. I can't have any salt after that. But that has a barcode in the back with all the data in it. Why can't my Fitbit app just blip and take that in? You know?
Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah, but I mean, this stuff should be logging without you having this again. I mean, there's value in there, but spending time chasing that dog is rough. Spending time at 9 o'clock at night. Oh, what did I eat today? Oh, I did this. Oh, you know, I mean, the whole point of the tracker, like especially the Fitbit, is that it's doing it for you. It's going to tell you about your calories burned. It's going to tell you about your steps.
Yeah, it should be able to make your life easier. Maybe that's an app that we need to make real quick. Barcode scanner.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is the natural progression for Apple, right? This is when they released, when they announced health in iOS 8, you could kind of see the writing on the walls, right? Tighter integration there.
I'm a little worried about this. The OLED, okay, so that's the touchscreen. If they're going to be looking at something like blood oxygen or even like heart rate or whatever, mm-hmm. a lot of companies now have built these wrist-based LED focused heart rate monitors. And what's interesting is, of all the companies that have built them, only one of them has figured out how to do it properly on dark skin. And given the Apple commercials I've seen, I don't know if Apple will be able to pull that off.
I never even considered that.
Yeah, so one company, Soch, they have three LEDs, two green ones and a yellow one, because the yellow one is more helpful when it comes to dark skin. Whereas others, like you go online and you look at some of these heart rate monitors, the complaints on Amazon are like, hey, I'm dark skinned, and it's totally off, right?
Yeah.
And this is something I can understand, because when I put my hand under my simple human soap dispenser, unless my hand is facing up where it's pale,
wow,
nothing comes down.
Wow, never even considered that problem.
Technology is racist, man. It happens at every single movie theater, every single airport, unless my hand is faced up and there's light on the palm of my hand. Yeah, it doesn't work.
Wow. Black people problems, right?
Indian people problems, yeah. Mexican people problems, most of the world problems, really.
Okay, moving on here. So Google, this just announced today, Google said that it had bought Skybox Imaging, a company that provides high-resolution photos using satellites, for $500 million in cash. Google says that their satellites will help keep our maps accurate with up-to-date imagery. Over time, we also hope that Skybox's team and technology will be able to help improve internet access and disaster relief, which are areas that Google has long since been interested in. Skybox provides sub-meter images as well as 90-second videos from its network of small satellites. What do you think about this deal, this Skybox Imaging deal?
Well, on the deal side, it just seems like everybody's buying everybody. There are going to be three companies in the whole entire tech industry. Yeah. The minute you have a good idea, you get snapped up. In terms of what's going on here, it looks like they're doing Vine. From space, Instagram video from space.
It's a maps arms race, as well as when they're done with when on top of satellite imaging for maps, they can also use this to expand internet. Like basically, we talked about it.
The satellite use for the internet stuff.
Right.
So one interesting thing here is that I was reading, and you know, Google has this new car, the car that you don't have to drive, the car that drives itself, right? How do they do this? It's not a question of just GPS. The infrastructure for the functionality is based on hyper-accurate mapping of the area, hyper-accurate data of the lights, the intersections, all that stuff. So this technology – so for instance, if you were to buy – a Google car right now, drop it in the middle of New York, it wouldn't work because it doesn't have a super hyper accurate map of New York. It has a super hyper accurate map of Mountain View and some of the other places they tested it. So this technology looks very much like it's what's going to get them there pretty quickly. And once they have that service all built out, you know, they start knocking on the doors of the likes of Lexus, Mercedes, Ford, Chrysler, GM, and saying, hey, look, you can sell a car. We'll just be integrated into your car with our thing.
Yep.
And those guys are going to be happy because they're not software experts, and they want the liability to be on Google if something goes wrong. So I can see this being a thing. Given the Vodafone story with the wires and how the government's using them, you know, I'm kind of like obviously a little sketched out, but...
Right, and we know Google has had its issues with the NSA before, and data has gone to the NSA, whether Google willingly gave it to them or not.
So, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is also one of those things that pushes you toward the singularity. Now, you go to this Recode article, and you know the applications that they use this thing for are monitoring agriculture, for identifying pest infestations. You know, checking on assets, updates about oil storage. You know, these are very real things that are part of the economy in the world. So the fact that you can hyper accurately see these things happening in real time or close to real time, and then make judgments on them are kind of cool. I could see Google like tying into Bloomberg and giving people updates, stock traders updates on kind of how things are moving when it comes to futures and agriculture based on this kind of thing. So it's There's a lot here. I'm just glad it didn't cost $1 billion. It's kind of interesting to me that this is $500 million for satellites in space and Tumblr cost $1 billion.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's worth it. Like this for this application is worth it in this case. Speaking of maps, a report from TechCrunch sheds new light as to why iOS 8 did not feature significant improvements to maps at this year's WWDC, with an inside source noting that many developers left the company as map improvements for iOS 8 were not finished in time. The source adds that tasks were very badly planned, with developers having to jump from project to project. Another source at Apple says, I would say planning, project management, and internal politics issues were a much more significant contributor to the failure to complete projects than developers leaving the group. The bottom line is that...
it's a hot mess over at Apple when yes, it comes to the maps.
Yes.
That's the bottom line. They got yep. people who are leaving. They got people who are not solving the problems they're supposed to solve, or not dropping the ball when it comes to getting the deliverables in. This is interesting. I mean, part of this has to be because, you know, Scott Forstall probably had his super incredibly like dedicated people, and they may have been unhappy during the transition.
Yep.
And then there's just the fact that he had a style of getting things done. And while it may not have been the perfect style, Maps was a catastrophe when it came out. It delivered products on time. I think it's possibly it's a better move to not include an update to Maps than to include a shitty update to Maps. I think they've learned their lesson there. Tim Cook's writing letters, open letters to users saying sorry. You know, the newspapers are up there saying things like, these people got trapped in random part of Australia with no gas because they tried using Apple Maps. Like they're not going to screw it up.
Yeah. I agree. I think slow and steady. You know, basically it's virtually impossible to do overnight, relatively overnight, and we're talking about Apple's been at this for a few years, but nowhere near as long or with the data set that Google has had.
What's interesting, though, is that, you know, Apple has moved to this, quietly moved to this thing that one of my Apple-loving friends the other, like a few years ago was like, Microsoft innovates by acquiring. But it's clear that between buying HopStop and Embark and Beats and TestFlight that, you know, Apple's picking up these technologies as well. HopStop is one of the best apps on iOS, and the idea that they bought them to integrate them into Maps makes a lot of sense. I just hope that they don't shut down HopStop until Maps is up and running with that focus. That will bring people back to Maps. Google's transportation, public transportation directions are pretty tight. And while I love using Waze and I'm driving the car, I tend to use Google Maps for everything else because they have the walking, cycling, public transportation, and you know, directions.
Right. Yeah.
So Google's definitely winning in this space, and just once again, you look at the mobile space, and you know Google is doing some serious leadership.
Yeah. All right. Now, Dwayne, you brought this last story in our headlines to us, and it's about a deal. YouTube has been trying to launch a subscription music streaming service, and it's been working with major labels. And negotiating with independent labels as well, but it's been threatening to block videos of independent label artists if they can't come to agreement on the licensing fees for YouTube's new service.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story. I mean, we were just talking about Google and how they're leading in the mobile space. Turns out they're leading in the music space in a big, big way. Yeah. YouTube is now the de facto mouthpiece of the music industry. That's where people discover music through videos, and
it's a major music discovery service. It's like whenever someone mentions a band or a song to me, I don't try and find it on Spotify. I go to YouTube and find it because I know
it'll be there. Because you type it in Google, and when you type it in Google, you get the YouTube video. And while there are always a whole bunch of piggybacking fake versions or like live whatevers, you know, there's usually like the official or the Vivo or something, and that's how you check it out. So YouTube apparently wants to cash in on this, this popularity, the fact that they've cornered the market in the music video space. And what they've done is they've basically said, hey, big labels, this is the deal we're going to give you. Small labels, you need to saddle up and join this other deal that we have for small labels, independent labels. And small labels are like, wait a minute, how come I'm not getting paid what the other guys are getting paid? And Google's like, well, you don't know what they're getting paid because we made it all secret and hush-hush. But the fact is, you're independent and they're not, really need their music, and we have a better bargaining position with you, which is interesting because when you look at Google's usage, 8 of the top 10 videos are music videos every month, and a third of those music videos are independent. So it's not like independent is tiny. It's just that major labels make up 60%, independent make up, you know, 30%. That's pretty significant. That Google is going to try to, like, you know, force a deal on these guys for the subscription music service is really pretty interesting, especially when you think about the fact that everyone has the paradigm of searching and viewing the song right now. The idea that you're going to have to pay to see those videos, you know, it might drive these, it might drive people away to Vimeo or something that doesn't have that right. deal. So it doesn't sound like it's a very positive thing when it comes to what Google's and YouTube's doing. I mean, Google does a lot of great stuff. Do No Evil does not really comply with this situation. And it's been likened to what Amazon's doing with books. Small independents, they're saying, hey, look, we're going to put all your books on wait lists. We're going to say that they're not in stock, even when they are in stock, because we want you to, you know, negotiate in what we, you know, in our interests and not necessarily in yours. So these two companies are just totally changing the industry, and I think the consolidation of that is definitely getting in the way of certain freedoms that we're used to, idea of an open market and things like that.
It's all changing. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the books I'd like to talk about this week are the How to Train Your Dragon series by Cressida Crowell. These are kids'
it's
books.
It's a great series.
Yes.
Yeah. It's quality fantastic. Movies as well, too.
Yep.
Yeah, I got to say, the first How to Train Your Dragon movie came out right around the time that the Avatar movie came out, the one with the blue people.
Sure.
And they both involve flying on dragon-like things.
Yep.
And I like the How to Train Your Dragon one so much more than the Avatar movie.
Yeah.
When it came to that specific, I mean, generally, yes. But when it came to that specific thing, I felt like I was flying in How to Train Your Dragon 3D. Yeah, it was great. The books are astounding. They're really about teaching kids how to solve their own problems and how to work together and all that stuff that you want kids to do. I think it's one of those things where you get a kid reading these books and they might develop not only, like, you know, reading skills, but a love of reading. So they're definitely good. But if you can't have them looking at the book, if you're doing a long trip to see grandma in Minnesota or whatever, great thing that they're on the Audible, listen on your way up.
Yeah, absolutely. And the series is read by Doctor Who's 10th Doctor, David Tennant.
Oh, there you go. Is he using the Scottish accent?
Slew of Scottish accents to this high-spirited rendering of Hiccup Horrendous Haddock's journey towards true heroism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the whole Hiccup story is just about becoming something that people think you're not.
Yep.
You know, in a positive way. Not
growing
sort of like
into your own abilities. Yes.
Right. Unlike Anakin, where you just become something that's evil. This guy becomes, you know, he becomes a hero. People saying he can't, he's not going to be able to do it. Right. And he does pay some serious consequences when becoming a hero, but nothing can keep him down. And that kind of self-confidence is something that I think both children and adults can appreciate.
Yep, I agree. So if you've got kids, or even if you're just a kid at heart, go to Audible and you can pick up any one of the How to Train Your Dragon series. I think they have almost every single one. There's 9 books in the series, and they have 7 out of 9 of those books. So it's almost the full series that they've got.
David Tennant's holding out for those last 2 books and it's a better contract.
So to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Using that URL helps us out on this show. And even if you don't like the Audible service, even if you hate it, you can quit it and you still get to keep the book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, what delights are coming in the next year for your game consoles and PCs? Take a listen to this and come on back. Thank you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafwakan. At this week's E3 Electronic Entertainment Expo, where Video Gaming World previews the games it'll unleash in the next year, all of the major consoles and some major developers each had their press conference in Los Angeles. I went to the show. Let's break down some of the press conferences that happened this week.
I like how they call them press conferences instead of keynotes.
Yeah,
because that's what a keynote is. It's effectively a press conference without the questions.
A keynote, I think, a keynote implies the major announcement in a convention, in a conference. Mm-hmm. And this isn't really a conference per se. I think
it's not like a single OEMs conference,
right? Not it's one like to a, rule them all.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Microsoft's conference, Xbox boss Phil Spencer told thousands of attendees that this would be all about the games in a message that couldn't be more clear, as last year's emphasis on the strength of Xbox One as a multimedia and live TV platform was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. They widely considered a mistake by the tech press. Yeah,
they want to emphasize that this is a games machine that also does other stuff that no one here really wants to hear about.
I mean, E3 is all about gaming, so you know they had to come correct. We've already seen Microsoft pivot in the Xbox One space by making it so that you can buy the device without the Kinect feature, which drops the price by about $100, which puts it right in line with the Sony PlayStation 4, which kind of came out and was showing everybody that it's a dedicated gaming thing. We're not trying to gin you up with other stuff, and our price is $100 less than Microsoft.
Like,
there's
some hints that the one of the reasons that Sony won E3 last year, won in the court of public opinion last year, because Microsoft did focus so much on multimedia and live TV usage of the Xbox One, and not
that's
enough
just the wrong
games.
Audience. Yeah,
yeah, and in like fact, on the show floor, on the exhibition floor, I didn't see anything about Xbox One's multimedia platform on the floor itself. It was all games on the show floor.
The CES is a place where they could talk about all that stuff.
Yeah,
but,
E3
is where they really get to focus on the games. And when Sony came out with the PlayStation 4, that's all they talked about. Like, we're a platform for gamers. They realized there was a niche that they could attack that Nintendo could no longer really play around in, the just hardcore gaming sector. And, you know, Xbox was kind of going for that wide open sector. But yeah, and then there's the whole fact that Xbox, they got rid of their $60 mandatory to play your own Netflix subscription.
Sure.
So that's another thing where Microsoft has pivoted to be more competitive with the PS4.
Yep. Well, let's talk about some of the games that they did mention during the press conference. Halo 5, which is exciting for all the Halo fans. First of all, something that they've been looking forward to. There's a upgraded version of all of the other Halo games coming as well, remastered version for the Xbox One. Forza Horizon 2, racing game, which will have a day and night cycles, dramatic weather, and the ability to set up driver clubs. They showed off a demo of Fable Legends, which this version allows you to be a villain and take the role of a dungeon master, arranging enemy traps and attacks.
As well as cooperative play, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's all about that cooperative play.
There was a lot of that in the demos that I saw at E3 today. Scalebound, which we're not entirely sure what this game is about, but it involves giant monsters and headphones somehow. The creators of Limbo, the eerie, atmospheric indie game, have created a project for the Xbox One that will appear first on the Xbox One called Inside, And it's set in a dark Orwellian world of monochrome graphic characters trapped in a vast retro-futuristic edifice from the appearance of it. There's a new Lara Croft game, Rise.
That is an awesome description.
That description, I have to give credit of that description to where I'm reading this from, which is The Guardian, who's they've summarized the Xbox conference quite handily. The next Lara Croft game, Rise of the Tomb Raider, which is due out in winter of next year.
I'm so glad that they are actually releasing another one, given the lack of success of the previous one.
I don't know if it's... Well, first of all...
You liked it, Tosin.
I loved the last Tomb Raider. Mm-hmm. I don't know how successful it was, but I loved it. It was one of my favorite games of last year.
Yeah, they didn't promote it the way they could have, and I think now they really... Now that they know there's a base audience for it, they're going to get that cult following, and hopefully they can blow it up. I mean, Tomb Raider was all but dead for a long time, I feel like, but it came back strong in that last game.
Yeah, we'll see. Some of the artistic and top people that were in the company that made last year's game are no longer there. So,
another game was Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, which showed off a street battle in futuristic Korean city. Super detailed visuals, including generous use of smoke and particle effects. And a game called Sunset Overdrive, which... is a little hard to describe, but it seemed to be sort of like everything plus the kitchen sink in a sort of cooperative fighting game. And I will say that being on the show floor, on the exhibition floor, Sunset Overdrive was the game that had the longest line and the most people drawn to it than any other game on the show floor. So,
see, that surprises me because... when I saw Sunset Overdrive, it was quite a comical style of game where you would sort of run around trying to destroy things and hopping from it was an entertainment. They were showing off basically an amusement park, and you were just kind of running around on everything. And it just looked, I mean, it looked okay, but it didn't look like something that would be a big driver. It just seemed.
It might have been just the mystery. Like, what is this? It looks pretty cool. I guess.
But the mystery was not there for me like it was with some other titles, or even when we'll later on touch upon some of the PlayStation stuff.
I will say that I feel like, and this is anecdotal, that is what people are... That's the zeitgeist, is something a little offbeat and unusual and...
And you see it in person and you really want to get close.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the other game that I saw at the Microsoft booth that was drawing a large crowd was, I can't remember what the name of it was, but it was sort of like a mod of Dark Souls, I think. It was a really sort of comic. A comic, outrageous sort of pushed to the extreme version of zombie fighting.
I mean, that's still going to be big. It's going to be big for the next few years, the whole fighting of zombies and yada, yada, yada. So I can see that being, you know, just refinements on that kind of sector. You see anything when it comes to PC stuff?
I didn't see anything really. Oh, well, there was a couple things that I saw. Yes. So Project Spark, which is their sort of open world creation, adventure, engine, they were pushing as being, available on the Xbox One and for Windows 8.1.
Mm-hmm.
And, other than that, I didn't see a whole lot more, that was pushed for Windows.
Gotcha. Yeah. Cause you know, one of the things I always see right around this time of year are all the ads for the video cards that are coming out. And I look at these things and $500 for a thing that takes up two slots and yada, yada, yada. And I'm just kind of like, wow, this is not a sector that I'm in anymore, but I like to follow it because I used to be really, really into it. And that's, you know, people are, this is where they make their big money. That's interesting.
Yeah. Anything else about Microsoft's offerings before we move on to the next bit?
I mean, I think it's good that Microsoft did concentrate on the gaming. They had a few sort of new surprise titles, but a lot of things were things that we'd seen before, just with a little bit more refinement to them. For example, further shots of Call of Duty or things like Assassin's Creed, etc., etc. And now the thing that I think kind of hurts Microsoft a bit, or at least it did for me here, is for quite a lot of the titles that they showed off and quite a lot of the ones that people really enjoyed are titles that are either also going to be available on PC, and although that's a fairly small subset, that is still a pretty large population, or are also going to be cross-console capable, so also available on like the PlayStation. So I think, you know, I think it was a much better press conference than others that we've seen Microsoft have. But I think it still stood in the shadows of some of the other ones we're going to discuss later on.
Yeah, and no one ran away from it.
Right. What was that, Michael Bay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could have been CS, but it doesn't
matter. I think you're right, but I got the reference. Mm-hmm. So the next conference that day, which was Monday, was EA's, and EA kicked off its conference with a pre-film video of DICE, developer DICE, discussing the Star Wars game it always wanted to make, Star Wars Battlefront.
Such a tease. They really didn't show anything. Just they were like, and it was actually really funny because I was talking to a friend about the Star Wars game and DICE's properties, and one of the things that he said was the interesting thing about DICE is that they always spend a ton of money, like sending people out to see like various environments where the filming happened, or
right.
get access to all sorts of models. But according to him, their games have all been pretty bad, so it doesn't seem like it helps. But it was quite the tease of the video, and I kind of wish they had actually showed something.
We'll know it when we see it later on, but of course they have to show a little bit of something. So
yeah, they were like, it's the game that we've always wanted, and yeah. I kind of said to myself, X-Wing versus TIE Fighter?
Yeah, right? Exactly. Speaking of franchises, one of the things that like struck me was the whole, you guys heard about the whole Ubisoft Assassin's Creed controversy, right?
No.
So basically, so Assassin's Creed has a new cooperative play, but none of the characters are female.
Yeah.
And the quote from Ubisoft was that putting in just one playable female character would double the work on Assassin's Creed Unity.
Really?
It's a, you know, basically the world thinks it's bullshit. But, you know, 2014, woman might be running for president, yada, yada, yada. And they're just like, oh, yeah, we overlooked the whole add a girl to the playable character set. Yeah, I mean, on some level, I'm sure that the 3D models are all the same. They're all a dude.
Yeah.
Right? And that would double the work, so they make a female playable model. But it's definitely something that you need to think about these days. I mean, especially if you want to expand the pie of who's playing these games, you know?
Yeah. I mean, how much harder could it really be?
Just put some, you know, I mean, it's not like it's a real person. Just put some boobs on the male figure and whatever, or not even.
Yeah, not draw. Even. Just yeah. expand the chest armor a little bit.
Exactly. So it's a really strange thing. VG247.com has a whole story on it, but it's just like ridiculous. Technical director James Theron said that making female characters is just too much work. It was on our feature list not so long ago, but it's a question of focus and product and production. We wanted to make sure we had the best experience for the character. A female character means you have to redo a lot of animation, a lot of costumes. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, that does seem wrong. It's 2014, people. I mean, come on. Let's have a little unity in games. The other games that they showed off, EA showed off, were Mass Effect 4, some concept art from that. The Sims 4, which I sat in on the show floor. I sat in a conference for that, so I got to see a little bit of Sims 4. It looks interesting. They've got some interesting sort of emotional components in The Sims that were previously non-existent in previous Sims games. So that
right. I mean, The Sims 1 is the one where you can get married now, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But their controversy was that you can get married, but you can't get married to
same gender.
Same sex, yeah. So, I mean, that's a thing. But, I mean, they're still, you know, doing a little bit better than... and there are apparently very big privileges associated with being married. So, sounds like these game producers have to have somebody on the pulse of what's going on in the world when they're putting this together, because these complaints are coming in, and they're not small.
Now, granted, I'm not sure if we know if that's set for the new Sims game.
Yeah, so, I don't know. There was nothing about that in the new any mention of that in what we saw in the Sims conference. So who knows? Perhaps they'll listen to their users. They also showed off a new PGA game. And their tagline for that was "Golf without limits."
Oh wow! Yeah, that's what I want. Turns me on. Golf without limits. I mean, Tiger Woods been singing that song for a long time. You only found out the wrong way, but yeah.
Wow, he went there. It was actually an interesting video to watch, like a cruise ship, a battleship from. I can't recall if it was a historical like Pearl Harbor, if it was like futuristic, but a battleship coming across the green and allowing you to hit the ball over it. But I mean, that's sort of a little. It's a different spin for a PGA game. It's like one of those older, more mini golf type games. Mm-hmm. You know, would experiment in that golf. Sort of. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I feel like they asked Michael Bay, like, how would you make this more hardcore? Put a boat in it, you know?
Yeah, when that comes crashing in. Yeah. And you can hit your golf ball over it, too.
Make exactly. That boat explode.
Like, have a robot just drop on top of a dinosaur with a sword.
The question is, are the people who are playing the PGA golf game asking for these type of elements? Because I don't really know what segment likes those, or yeah, I mean, like likes those games to purchase them. You know, I remember playing what's it called, the golf game on computer that used to come with Windows, right? I mm-hmm. enjoyed that sort of thing, but I don't know if it was enough for me to purchase a full fledged game.
Well, part of it's that somebody in there did some market research and said we got to mix it up a little bit. In today's age of downloadable content, it kind of seems as if, and I'm no super expert, but it kind of seems as if they could have released a more standard format game and then had an add-on pack that added the boat and all the other extreme unlimited golf awesomeness that they want to put in. That way they don't alienate the true customers, but those guys can get a little bit, you know, a little bit extra fun out of it once they played the game straight through, you know. I wonder if they put Mickelson and his whole like insider trading part in there. There are no limits. I'm insider trading as I hit four.
Also, the usuals from EA, Madden 15, FIFA 15, Mirror's Edge 2, which is unusual. I don't know who is asking for another Mirror's Edge game, but there it is. And Battlefield Hardline, which pits cops and bad guys against one another on the streets.
Yeah, that one reminds me a bit of Payday. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. more dynamic in terms of, you know, being able to play with a lot more people and being able to play that sort of cops, robbers games that
can you know, be like a community cop, like one of those cops that like focuses on understanding the community they're working in, you know, like figuring out what the social problems are, you know, find a prostitute, get her some help because she's on the drug. Can you do all that? Or is it just
you could
shooting
probably people? Wander around, but most likely you'd get shot.
It's DLC, I'm sure.
But yeah, no, I mean, it actually looked pretty interesting in terms of, well, I guess a better word for it is it looked pretty frenetic and looked like something that could could actually be fun to play with a bunch of people. One of the unique things that they did was on stage they said, "Hey, open beta right now, so you can go
you
sign
can
up.
You can jump
for...
into your own underserved community as a cop and start killing young people,
or as a robber and start killing the.
You can pretend that you're a person who decided to go with the violent world after living in an underserved community.
Was actually what I found kind of funny about the whole video that they showed was, you know, after all this like crazy. Violence where, you know, people are shooting one another, where they showed the perspective from the different players. There was this one place where you basically one guy is still left alive with the loot and he goes in the elevator and just shuts the elevator door and it's like quiet for, you know, a brief second before jumping right back into the whole sort of chaos. But it actually seemed kind of interesting, a little bit different than your typical Battlefield games, and I decided, you know, go ahead and sign up for a free beta and maybe try it out, see if it's any fun.
You gotta tell us how it is.
Anything else on EA before we move on to Ubisoft?
I haven't played many sporting titles in a long time, you know, probably since the days of FIFA 1994 as well as NBA Jam, but some of the things which they were doing with, especially with the new FIFA, looked pretty amazing in terms of really getting that true feeling for character models and allowing you to dance with the ball, that each thing is really its own unique object. And so it's kind of refreshing to see that there is still the ability to innovate when you're creating basically a sports title every year, right? There's still some room for improvement.
Mm-hmm. They can always make it as more real. Still, though, I kind of think on some level, if I have the time and energy, I just try to go out and play the game myself. The sports games never had the escapist feeling for me that I get when I play some of the science fiction titles.
That's true.
Okay, so moving on to Ubisoft. Ubisoft showed off only a handful of games, but I think a couple of them were like fairly had big seismic ripples. Far Cry 4 being one of them. And I actually played a little bit of Far Cry 4 on the show floor today.
How was it?
It looked stunning. I mean, graphically, it looked stunning. I didn't last very long, I will say. I was I rode an elephant through an enemy camp and shot up a bunch of enemies while I was crashing through the camp on an elephant. And then was
where's your humanity? You know that element, that elephant probably took a lot of fire, Andy.
It did actually. Jerk. It did take fire and eventually died in the enemy camp, and so did I. So wow. Yeah.
Now, did you play with someone else? Because one of during their video on the stage, they showed a couple people playing together in cooperative mode.
I didn't. They only had a single player. You could choose to either crash an elephant through the camp, fly over the camp, and snipe from there, or stealthily sneak into the camp. And I chose the elephant.
By the way, speaking of
the elephant in the room.
Well, speaking of the Ubisoft conference, they also had Aisha Tyler as the host.
Especially funny since Assassin's Creed has no women in it.
That's her. I think that's either the second or third year in a row that she's been the host for Ubisoft.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she's,
so that's pretty awesome.
She's usually pretty funny, too. I mean, she really knows how to...
Well, Far Cry is definitely, like, the Archer of video games, right? You can see Archer doing everything that happens in Far Cry. And since she's on there, it makes sense to me.
She's tall, too.
Yeah, man hands.
And cute, I think. Far Cry, I mean, man hands or not, I think she's...
The character she plays is man hands. I don't think she has.
That's how we get ants.
That's how we get ants, exactly.
Just Dance 2015, The Division, which we've talked about... We talked about The Division in last year's at last year's E3.
And I'm still as jazzed as ever for this game.
Yeah,
I think...
sound like you are.
It's amazing.
It's been another year.
This is what like next generation gaming is, right? I've always been a huge fan of cooperative play.
Yeah.
But the graphics are there, the dynamics, the group dynamics working together is there, the ability for other players to hop off
in and out on other devices, you know, tablets, etc. This is next gen at its core. Mm-hmm. Now the question is, can they live up to it?
Massive multiplayer.
Right. Like, can they live up to it? We've seen that recent game that came out that was delayed a couple years, delayed a few months. What was it called?
Duke Nukem Forever?
No, not Duke Nukem. The one where you are where you're basically a hacker around the
Watch Dogs.
Watch Dogs, right? So Watch Dogs was supposed to be that sort of next gen potential.
Yeah.
But from what I've read and heard about it, I don't think it's completely lived up to that. I think it's sort of turned into, you know, a typical shooter. It hasn't had the full immersion that was necessarily to put it to the top. I think it was still relatively fun, but
yeah,
The Division, I think, really holds that promise. And I really hope it can deliver.
It looks pretty cool. I'm still waiting for the game where you can log in and you can run a starship, and then you can log in and you can be one of the Marines on that starship, and then you could log in and be one of the people defending the beach on the planet, or you could log in and be like a tank operator or whatever. You know, that kind of thing? Where it's like real-time strategy for some people, but first-person shooter for others. I mean, it's going to be hard to pull off, but I think it's possible.
Well, you know a game that we're going to mention a little bit later, No Man's Sky, is a little bit like that, or has hints of that.
Hints of it, right. But it'd be so cool if you're like a general and you're telling your ships to go left and right, and then you're controlling like a big-ass ship and you're deploying fighters, and then, you know, somebody else is actually fighting on those fighters, and then the fighters have to clear a way for you to land your troops on the ground, and then like someone, you know. I mean,
there are some games out there currently that try to do things like that, but not to that extent, not to that like depth.
Yeah, like every level.
I think once you have that would be awesome.
I mean, it'd have to be like a worldwide game to keep all of the usership going at the same time, but I think that's you know, everyone gets a piece. That'd be great.
Also, Assassin's Creed Unity, which takes place during the French Revolution, you get team play once again. I think team play is a major theme of this year's E3. Up to four players can work together to help you fight your enemies. Shape Up, which is another exercise game.
Do you get to cut off Louis' head? Is my question.
In Assassin's Creed Unity? I don't know.
I mean, if you can probably cut off Marie Antoinette's head. You just can't play as a woman. So violence to the women, but not strength.
It looked great. It just didn't. It just was not ready for. You know, they're
2014.
Not 14. Yeah. Valiant Hearts: The Great War, which is a World War I game. Interesting sort of choice for Ubisoft.
I think World War I is really underserved as a conflict when it comes to
Greg Davies both feel that way.
World War I is the beginning of what we call modernity. Yeah. I mean, before World War I, there were kings everywhere, right? All over Europe, there were kings or archdukes or whatever. Now you got like what? Spain and England are the only two big countries with a king. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, World War I, everything changed. Technology went crazy, and it's 100 years old.
Yeah, I think you would probably really enjoy Valiant Hearts. I actually, prior to E3, I watched a semi-review or intro on the a preview of that game, Valiant Hearts. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like a very sort of touching
very
game.
Somber, very, you know, there's not a lot of sort of action and adventure focus on it. It's more about sort of the real effects of war.
Yeah. And
yeah, man. I mean, it's
very
so
cute
much
dog too. Yeah, I think it's one of those games that's gonna have some great impact and stay with us for a bit. So,
I mean, that war is effectively the Uber prequel to the Second World War, which is sort of like the most just war of all time, right?
Sure.
I mean, German shepherds almost went extinct during that war. There's so many things about that war; it's a crazy war.
And Rainbow Six Siege was the
Tom Clancy's.
Yes, Clancy's Rainbow Six Siege.
Yeah, that was fairly interesting because I think unlike other Rainbow Six games, this one pitted – it was basically a five-on-five sort of match where you had to rescue a hostage. And the first thing that happened is that while – that you sort of had the hostage takers and the – I guess, police force or the SWAT team. And one person from the SWAT team rolled in basically as sort of rover that they were looking in to try and scope out where the hostage was, mm-hmm. While the takers were sort of boarding up parts of the house. And once they figured it out, they had a limited amount of time to figure out how they wanted to breach the house. And there was a lot of – the pretty cool thing about it was there was a lot of destruction capabilities of the environment. So a lot of environmental destruction, including like the ability to like breach the floor, right? To blow a hole in the floor and jump down to the bottom level. And like just all sorts of really cool touches in there. So I think that I think it's going to – I think that one's going to be popular with a large crowd of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, I think I think Rainbow Six already has a built-in audience, and as does any sort of Tom Clancy game, and I think this is just going
it's to... It's got like a 15-year... it's 15 or 16 years old now.
Yeah.
You know, the series, yeah. So it's got a really big following.
And you know what? Overall, for Ubisoft's press conference, I think they've always, you know... Comparing it to last year, I think it's just another solid press conference for them. It's always a little quirky, but they always have something interesting and fun to show. So I think another solid one for them.
All right, moving on to Sony's press conference. Sony's was the last of a press conference of Monday. They kicked off their E3 press conference with Destiny, the next game from Bungie. And this looks, they've got a bunch of consoles playing Destiny on the show floor, on the exhibition floor. And they're giving out vouchers to go see it throughout the day. I'm hoping to catch Destiny tomorrow when I go back there. It looks interesting. You know, it's Bungie, it's MMO. It's destructible environments. It's basically, you know, the guys who made Halo making a MMO. So it's an interesting new thing for them.
And yeah, it had a lot of Halo-esque touches to
yeah.
it. I think
yeah.
one of the really – and this is sort of like a thread you saw throughout the conference for Sony was the – was things being available sooner rather than later,
mm-hmm.
As well as special – additions and betas and releases for the PlayStation console. So, for example, Destiny is one of those games where I think PlayStation gamers would be able to start getting the beta on July 17th. And we all know that Destiny, I believe, is going to be available also for the Xbox One. They also announced the new PlayStation bundle, a white PlayStation that would
That's
be
right.
bundled with Destiny as well, too. So I think it was just like a repeated theme that, hey, you could get this game with our console and get all this additional cool stuff with it. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, those guys are killing it. I don't know how I feel about the white consoles because they get dusty. But, you know, it's always something. I definitely like look at Sony, and I think that they are... They're doing it right this time around. I mean, obviously the PS3 was a big hit. In the end, the Xbox outsold it. But, I mean, the idea of your Blu-ray player and all that stuff was big back when that stuff showed up in 2005-06. I think what they're doing now with the focus on the game, saying you can have all these games, plus we've got some exclusives, and plus we've got this new, you know, some of these new techs. And we're diving hard into the VR. I mean, that's stuff that makes you want to, you know, drop $400. See what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, you know, on that note, I will say that one of the things they showed off at the press conference is Project Morpheus, their experimental VR headset.
Their VR solution, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually got a chance to try this on the show floor today. And having previously tried the Oculus Rift, and the comparison, you have to make the comparison between the two because it's the obvious.
You're killing us. What's the comparison?
Well, I will say that they are in early, early, early alpha. It's essentially a VR headset that works. It doesn't work to the extent or nearly as well as the Oculus Rift. The resolution isn't nearly as sharp as the Oculus Rift. It's
Is it sharper than putting your Samsung phone in a viewfinder in front of your
You know,
eye?
That's difficult to say, even. Even that's difficult to say. I, you know what? It feels to me
so
like...
Oculus is killing it. Sony's got some work to do.
Yeah. It feels like, to me, that Sony felt the pressure from Oculus. They knew that they had this in their R&D, and they had to put it out there.
Say something. Yeah. But they're doing what Samsung did with the Galaxy Gear, releasing a product. I mean, the product isn't released. So we got to give it some time.
Yeah.
But the idea that you're seeing something out there that's not in a great place.
Right.
That's a little right. Disappointing. I'm still a little upset that Sony couldn't make a deal to pick up Oculus, that Sony North America didn't say, hey, we should do this. But, I mean, sometimes the Japanese game companies have interesting decisions that they make. It's a cultural thing. Like the whole, remember Wii? You had to put in like a unique 16-digit number to make a username.
Friend codes? Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah, I mean, like they choose a different path.
Well, and Sony's always been about proprietary formats. So I'm sure this is right along the line with, you know, Sony's like, we could buy something that somebody else is developing, or we could just do it ourselves and force everybody to play by our standards.
Exactly. Memory sticks, go.
Yeah, exactly. That's an excellent example. Some of the other games that they talked about during the press conference, The Order 1886, which is a takes place during 1886, blends it's a Victorian era setting, blends fantasy with reality, and it looks interesting. I just saw little bits and pieces of it. London during the Victorian era, but with the fantasy
steampunky kind of thing to it.
Yeah.
So that's like that Victorian era is just ripe right now for all the steampunk
sure.
stuff. Yeah.
Entwined, a game about two souls that are in love but cannot be together. You control two characters at once, each with one analog stick. This looks interesting as well. A sequel to Infamous First Light. A Little Big Planet 3, which I played a little bit of on the show floor.
It looks so cute.
I didn't even know there was a 2.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 2 is great, by the way. Little Big Planet is one of those series that my daughter and I play probably more often than anything else we play. She loves that. So I'm excited about Little Big Planet 3. I think it is. I asked them if it was going to be a PS4 exclusive, and the guy was very cagey about that answer, so...
Holding their breath to see. I mean, that's what they do. They hold their breath to see how it is on the release of the PS4. If they can make money selling it on the PS3,
yeah,
they're going to do it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many articles I've seen in the last 2 weeks. What you can get out of your PS3 now? It's not over yet. Don't throw it out. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a lot of games actually that were like, oh, but wait, we're also coming back for PS3 as well too. So
yeah.
There was nothing that I saw in Little Big Planet 3 that absolutely would make it a PS4 exclusive. Graphics are a little sharper, but other than that. Bloodborne, Dead Island 2, Grim Fandango will be remastered for the PS4 and PlayStation Vita. This has got to be exciting for people who are fans of that Lucasfilm, LucasArts title. I don't know if you guys have ever played Grim Fandango.
Yeah, it's a great game. I've never played it on a console. I've only played it on the PC, so that'd be interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a big big thing. Did you mention Far Cry 4?
I did.
You did.
Back in Ubisoft.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it was during I believe this was during the PlayStation announcement that they actually mentioned that with Far Cry 4, you can play it with another player. Mm-hmm. And that player does not even have to own the game.
Wow. Can they be the elephant, though? That's the question.
I'm not sure about that.
Would that be via the PlayStation TV, or is that independent?
I have a feeling the platform will probably connect. Like, you put your game in, and then somebody turns on their system wherever they are, and you sync up via the PS4 network, and there's an option in the game for the game holder to say, have this person join, and they basically play through downloadable content.
Right. So you invite them to play with you, and they can start that sort of co-op play.
I wonder if that game is more expensive. Unheard of. If that game is more expensive, like if that game costs $80 instead of $60, that would be worth it, right?
Yep. Yeah, I think so, but I sort of doubt that the game's going to be more expensive. I think they're just going to roll with the typical price point. But, I mean, I think the crowd kind of went crazy there because they're, like, set aback. Because when has anyone ever done this, something where, like...
Yeah, it's running away from revenue,
free,
almost.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing. And yeah. But, you know, that drives... Who knows? It's the sort of
it
thing,
drives
like...
drives users, and...
I think they're setting a precedence for that.
Yeah, ease of access.
Yeah, because Far Cry's always been, like, a super great one-player game, like, single-player game. So the fact that they're not only going to the community space with the storytelling, cooperative, but that only one of you needs to own it in order to get it done, I mean, that's really...
Hasn't that been the way that games for the Nintendo DS have worked for a while, where only one person needs to own the cartridge?
I'm not a DS user.
It's been a while.
Yeah. I think that is the case, but it's nice that they're, because that is definitely feels like a Nintendo move. But I'm glad that PlayStation is adopting that.
You know what it is? You know what else happens with this model? I think you're far more likely to get people. You know, like I'm like, hey Andy, let's go play Far Cry. I put it in. I invited you. Andy's playing Far Cry. And then one day I'm not at home or whatever, and Andy's like, you know what? I'm gonna get Far Cry because yep. I can play with Tosin or whatever. Or I can
absolutely.
Just play by myself. It's going to help a viral expansion of the game. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing.
Some of the other games they...
Did they announce Puzzle Fighter? Because that's important to me.
I didn't see anything Super Puzzle Fighter related.
I didn't see anything there.
Okay. I mean, the game came out in 97. I was just, you know...
developer Suda51 came out with a game exclusively for the PS4 called Let It Die. Which is twisted with lots of over the top violence.
Is that the sequel to Frozen? That like the new
Giant Squid, which is a studio formed by some of the people that made Journey, showed off a game called Abzu, set in the ocean. Looks atmospheric and cool. And then the game that we sort of hinted at earlier, No Man's Sky. This was sort of the standout hit of the PS4 press conference. It's hard to describe this, but it's adventure on a procedurally generated environment that takes place on both procedurally generated planets and also in the space between the planets. Like you can move from planet exploration to spaceship combat, and then right down to planet exploration again seamlessly within one session.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely good shit. Right?
Yeah, it looked very pretty, and you know I think one of the awesomest things about this game was during the press conference, you could really tell that this indie developer was just feeling it from the heart, right? Like this is his baby. Yeah. This is something that he really loves, and he's doing it because of for all the right reasons. And I was kind of touched by it.
That's the emotional story that people want to hear.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's what's kind of crazy is all the titles that you've mentioned, and mm-hmm. we're really only just tapping on like the tip of the things that they've mentioned in terms yep. of games, right? You know, Metal Gear Solid 5, Grand Theft Auto 5 coming there, another Batman game, Last of Us being remastered, Disney Infinity, Magicka 2. The list just goes on and on and on, and it's just...
There are too many titles, though. I mean, like, I hear it, and I'm like, oh, they look so cool, but I'm, like, gonna play, like, two of them.
Oh, but still...
It's good to know the system is vibrant.
The system, yeah?
The system is vibrant. Not even the system, the community. On some level, I think people were like, oh, video games, I don't know. But it's clear that video games are outshining Hollywood when it comes to sales and budgets and all those things. It's the future. I just kind of feel like they all kind of come out at around the same time.
But wait, there's more.
So one of the other things that I found really, I think... is really a groundbreaking about the PS4 announcement is they announced that, and it may seem like a small thing, but I think it's really important, is YouTube uploading is coming to the PS4. Direct YouTube uploading, and plus a partnership with Twitch. And then we've talked about how game
Twitch is built right into the other one.
How gaming videos are now like the lion's share of views on YouTube, outside of anything else, and how what a phenomenal movement this is with people just watching gaming videos, watching other people playing games.
And I mean, you did it when you were a kid. Your older brother, sister, cousins play Nintendo, your friend, and you just sit there staring at it, and you think, that's so cool. And you didn't always want to play it right then, but you like to watch it. And I think this is an extension of that situation.
Right. And really, there had never been an internet social a social sharing component to that until YouTube, and it kind of came into it on its own. If you look at some of the top YouTube content producers, most of them are gaming, are gaming related in one way or another. So for Sony to hook into this audience and make YouTube uploading directly,
it's kind of a no-brainer. Like you wonder if it wasn't there, you'd wonder why it wasn't there. So yeah. I'm glad they did it. Yep. You know.
They actually, I think, in addition to that, I believe it's for Twitch, but they mentioned that he would now have the ability to have your audience, talk to you during your gameplay and make suggestions and do things of that nature, which sort
That's
of
right.
gave an interesting murmur from the crowd as uh-huh. people
very
started
Matrix.
Thinking about a trolling.
It's also very Matrix gaming. You remember the first Matrix movie where Neo is running through the building at the end? He's like, go left. No, your other left. Like, your ability to actually process that information is going to be pretty difficult. So that's an interesting. I mean, I'm glad I'm putting it in there. We'll see how it takes off and how they allow people to control who's listening and stuff. On the old Quake games, there was a spectator mode, which allowed you to see live gameplay
right.
across the internet at any time, which is always exciting. Right. So this is a good extension of that.
They also showed off Metal Gear Solid V, The Phantom Pain. They announced that Grand Theft Auto V is being ported to the PC. Batman Arkham Knight. And their big sort of a surprise, one more thing announcement was Uncharted 4, A Thief's End. This would be the supposedly the last entry in the Uncharted.
Uh-oh, Andy's going to cry.
The Naughty Dog Uncharted saga. I love Uncharted series. I don't know about you guys.
Uncharted is
amazing. I know. I can see that you're going to, it's going to come out. And you're going to get on the show in the beginning what we're playing with, and you're going to tell us why you cried at the end of Uncharted.
I thought you were going to mention that when we mentioned that The Last of Us would be remastered for PS4.
Right.
That'll make him cry, too. Right. The beauty. The beauty.
Also, one other thing they mentioned on the hardware side is the Vita TV, which they had announced last year's E3, has been rebranded as PlayStation TV for North American and European audiences. It's going to be $99, and it'll give you the access to the library of PS Now titles and the ability to remotely access titles on your local network. You can pick it up as a standalone unit or part of a bundle with the DualShock 3 controller, 8 GB memory card, an HDMI cable, and a voucher for Lego the Movie video game. So, another addition in the streaming television small devices like the Chromecast.
Set-top
boxes, except for this one actually plays games.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so does the Amazon one.
Sure, but this one is streams games from the basically in the same style as OnLive, like live game streaming from a central server.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many set-top boxes; it's incredible. But I suppose if you have a PS3 in your main situation, and you're you got like maybe a TV in the bedroom or something, the PlayStation TV is one of those things you can attach to that. You know, I'm trying to figure out the best scenario for owning and using a PlayStation TV over your PlayStation device.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you're right. If you have a PlayStation and you want it to stream from somewhere else in your net in, on your network. Yeah, I think that would be the way.
Yeah.
Anything else about Sony before we move on to Nintendo, which had their press conference today?
Well, one of the interesting things that Sony mentioned was also the was they were moving into the TV space and how they're going to be starting a new sort of graphic novel interpretation of the show Powers. Well, they're starting series.
They have a lot of content, right? So yeah. To begin with, you know, Sony getting into the – a lot of you see a lot of these guys showing up with their – their hardware and saying, hey, I'm Amazon, I'm, or you know, hey, I'm Netflix, I'm going to start making my own content. Sony has a ton of content. If you were to just take their content and put it all out in one channel, they'd be like the fifth largest network in terms of viewership of their current content. So it's for them to like start making new stuff, it's, you know, I'm pretty sure it's going to be relatively good quality stuff, and they can you know, they have the ability to put this stuff, you know, their older stuff is all over the place, but this new stuff, again, probably be exclusive to these set-tops in the beginning and then get farmed out elsewhere. So I'm excited to see what they're doing because, you know, Sony Pictures Entertainment makes quality stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They've got a great media company behind them. You know, Nintendo is sort of second starters in this arena.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about Nintendo. They had their press conference today, and basically the biggest new game announcement for Nintendo this year was a as yet untitled Legend of Zelda game for the Wii U. They showed off a brief trailer of what appeared to be in-game footage, and it had it basically highlighted the game's expansive open world. In previous games, Hyrule had distinct and sometimes artificial feeling boundaries, but in this upcoming game, if you see landmarks on the map, you should be able to travel to them. You should basically anything that you see in the horizon, you should be able to travel to. The company says that they hope to recapture some of the sense of exploration from the first Zelda game. Something that's been lacking in the last few 3D titles.
Yeah, speaking of being progressive, it's hard to tell if in that trailer if you might actually be playing as Zelda and not as Link.
Right. The you play as a character, and it's hard to tell who that character is because it doesn't have Link's a trademark, you know, bright green vestments on. It seems to be like a character wearing blue, and we're not really sure. Of course, all the Zelda characters are somewhat androgynous, so it's hard to tell
maybe it's the guy from Drawn Together.
Yeah, it could be. I forgot about that. They also showed off Splatoon, a new first party franchise. It's a colorful multiplayer shooter in which two teams of up to four players fight to cover a map in colorful ink. The teams in the paint are color-coded, and you can transform into a squid to quickly swim through your paint to other side areas of the map. I played a little bit of this on the show floor. It reminded me a lot of... There was a game for the Wii called De Blob, and it was very similar to that, except De Blob, I don't think, had a multiplayer gameplay. And this one does. Plus, I think it's a lot easier to control than De Blob was. Looks like a lot of fun, you know. Good fun for multiplayer. It's not... once again, like, no... You know what to expect from a Nintendo title. You're not going to see a lot of blood and gore or high action or anything heart-stopping. It's just fun, basically fun for the whole family.
Cartoony-style fun.
Cartoony-style fun.
Almost everything here is first party, if not everything's first party. Nintendo is definitely becoming a more and more insular provider of software. You know, they're kind of the Apple of the gaming world. Our hardware, our software, that's what we do. And it's interesting to see how the Wii U is going to take off. I mean, like I said before the show, the Wii U is interesting because it plays the old Nintendo games too, the Wii games.
Yeah.
But so that's a big draw for anyone who wants that backward compatibility, especially if, you know, you're buying it for your children. Who wants to buy all those games again? Because they're still going to want to play them. But you know, I look at what they're doing, and it's just so first party. It's hard to see how they're going to get serious scale, especially with a device that came out a little early for the eighth generation, and doesn't seem to have all the features and expansibility. You know, I mean, at least it's HD, right?
Yeah. It's HD, but it's like nothing about the Wii U feels like it's like it couldn't be done on the previous generation of the Xbox or the PlayStation. Like,
yeah, the technology is like a generation behind. I feel like I looked at the Wii, and it seemed like I was looking at a fancy N64. And then don't even get me started about the Netflix playback on that thing. It looked like I was watching a TV from 1982.
Yeah. No, absolutely. We've talked about that on the show too before. Like, that is Nintendo's general problem, is they're just behind the times. Some of the other games that they announced: Kirby and the Rainbow Curse, Kirby with a claymation aesthetic, Yoshi's Woolly World, which has sort of a handmade scrapbook aesthetic of Kirby's Epic Yarn or a Little Big Planet, for example. Mario Party 10, Captain Toad's Treasure Tracker, which expands on the Captain Toad mini levels in Super Mario 3D World. Interestingly enough, a new NFC-enabled figurines called Amiibo, which is kind of like basically Nintendo's doing their own version of Skylanders or of Disney's Infinite. I can't remember what it's called now. Disney Infinite?
Yeah, Disney Infinite.
So basically, it's going to be, you know, the Nintendo characters, you put them on to the Wii with on a reader on the Wii, and they interact in games such as Smash Brothers, for example. So there we go.
You sound excited about this.
Yeah. Well, you know...
If you're going to merchandise your games, you might as well make it interactive.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Court of Public Opinion has already spoken about this year's E3 conferences, and they've already said that Sony has won once again this year, 2 years in a row.
I think Nintendo still had some pretty awesome things to show. Like, I knew... for one, the ability to import your own character, your own avatar into their Smash Brothers game.
Yeah.
And also another Star Fox game, which, you know, I'm sure there's a bunch
exciting.
Of fanatics, right? So there are a bunch of known titles that, you know, I was watching some videos and people are like, you know, maybe I will pick up a Wii U just as like my side little console. So I think there's some things that may help them a little bit, but in terms of like pure... If we're looking at winners and losers among the big three, I would say, you know,
I don't know if they're even part of the big three anymore. I think there's a big two and then there's Nintendo. That's not to say Nintendo's not a big thing. It's just so divergent from what Xbox and PlayStation are very much like Coke and Pepsi. And I feel like Nintendo is like Fanta. Like, it's not even competing with them anymore.
Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, well, Dr. Pepper's owned by Pepsi.
That is a pretty good analogy.
Well, Fanta is owned by Coke.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Well, I definitely do think that Sony killed it. Like, they had a ton of stuff all over the sphere, lots of things that are fairly exclusive to their console, and a lot of innovation. So I think, you know, I hadn't previously thought about getting a new console, and now I'm tempted to get a PlayStation 4, and so that is a positive, right? That's what
Sony wants.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The only thing about all this stuff is that, like, between the PlayStation 4 and the PSTV and all this other stuff, it's like I only have so many ports behind an Amazon box and, you know, whatever. I only have so many ports behind my television set, and, you know, I gotta whittle it down.
Or we could start a company and make some sort of proprietary box called.
But who wants all that junk around your TV?
Monster ports or something?
You just don't want all that. The problem is it's a lot of junk. Like a TV, especially today, you get them because they're thin and tiny or whatever. And while a console can't be that small, the fact that it's doing all that stuff makes it worth me putting it in my area, in my TV media cabinet, or whatever. When it comes to some of these other things, you know, like if I got the PS3 and I got the Apple TV, I'm probably not going to get the Amazon Kindle Fire TV. I'm probably not going to get the PlayStation TV. I'm probably, you know, I got to really think about the Wii U. Like, am I going to use it enough to justify having to look at another thing, having more cables, having less airflow? You know, like, it becomes logistically difficult. And in fact, that's one of the big reasons that's making me think about, you know, when it comes to PS4 or Xbox, it's not going to be both of them. It's going to be one, likely, because I just don't need all that stuff under my television set.
I have to say that being a PlayStation 3 owner and not a Xbox at all owner, I was already sort of leaning towards the PlayStation 4, and my opinion is not swayed at all. I think if I had to get another next-gen console, it would probably be the PS4. Anything else? Any other games or anything else announced at E3 that you want to talk about? I will say that I played...
I think we've thoroughly gone through the offerings at E3 today.
Yeah. We talked briefly about talking about Alien Isolation. And I played a little bit of Alien Isolation today, which is the alien-themed game that's sort of an homage to the original 1979 Ridley Scott Alien. It's not Marines and guns fighting a bunch of aliens. It's you fighting a single alien with...
Surviving.
Surviving. It's survival horror. And it's exciting and scary. So I recommend that for anyone who likes that classic alien feel.
And of course, Broforce showed its face again. I know I talked about it when I talked about some of the games I saw at PAX. So it's a classic side scroller. You are, 80s action star, blowing up everything.
Yep. I think that's what people are. I think people like that sort of comic offbeat, you know, balls to the wall, extreme, tongue-in-cheek action. I think that's why Sunset Overdrive went so well at the Microsoft booth. All right, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, has an artificial intelligence been created that can actually fool a human? And our drill down videos of the week, take a listen to this and come on back. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuwakin. Here's our last story for the evening before we sign off here. A Russian chatbot named Eugene Goostman has become the first to pass the Turing test, which is an assessment of machine intelligence first proposed in 1950 by a visionary mathematician, logician, and codebreaker Alan Turing. He's the guy that helped the Allies break the German code in World War II. The chatbot Eugene Goostman convinced 1 in 3 judges that it was a 13-year-old non-native English-speaking Ukrainian boy. Now, that to me, well, the rules for this contest, the Turing test, stipulate that if a computer passes the test, if it's mistaken for a human more than 30% of the time, and Eugene managed to convince 33% of the judges that it was human, the only machine contender at the competition to do so. And now the part of the there's like a lot of conditions to this, and I feel like it's a little bit of a like it's a little bit too conditional for me because
they're trying really hard to make the test work so that they can have a machine that is considered a winner.
Yeah, skew the test in the favor of the chatbot, and
even 30% is a little strange. I mean, like 50% would probably be more applicable. 51%, so you can say a majority of the people thought that it was a robot or thought that it was a human, as opposed to a third of people thought it was a human.
Yeah. Plus, to place all these conditions on it, that it's a 13-year-old, non-native English-speaking Ukrainian. I mean,
that's one strategy, right? Like,
yeah. So do you skew the rules to try and win the test, or what's appropriate here?
Well, if you want it reported on IO9, apparently you do. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, they're trying to get press on this sort of thing in a crowded media landscape. Yeah. So they skewed the test to make it work, and this is how they made it work. Obviously, you know, a 13-year-old doesn't communicate on the same level that an adult does.
Yeah.
Non-English speaking, that's also pretty helpful. And the broken English that the robot's pumping out seems more natural. And you throw in the Ukrainian part, and especially if they're throwing Cyrillic up there or something, you know, you're just kind of like, oh, maybe it is a kid from another country. They basically said, we're going to make the character that this machine is portraying as alien as possible, mm-hmm. so you can't recognize mm-hmm. its humanity.
Do you feel like there's anything significant about the accomplishment? However, all these conditions aside,
I mean, it's as significant as anything else, I suppose. It's going to be interesting seeing, you know, what comes next, because mm-hmm. they've gotten this far, and then the leaps in this technology are pretty large. So it's really about what comes next.
Yep. And for our drill down videos this week, we're going to throw in some of the impressive E3 trailers from the conference this year, including The Legend of Zelda Wii U, No Man's Sky, and the cinematic for Tom Clancy's The Division. So those should be really interesting. You'll enjoy those. I think that does it for our show, with the exception of going around the table here, and I'll start with Dwayne asking you, where can we find your work when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, that's DWAYNED. You can see some of the stuff I've written on thedrilldown.com. And this week, you can also check me out at the Blendover podcast. Just Google Blendover podcast, and Greg T. Davies and I talk about some interesting stuff, including what's going on with this Edward Snowden guy and the fact that his Russian asylum is about to go away. And what's going on with Secret, the social media network that actually is focused now on leaking information.
Toasted, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can find my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. And then, of course, R2 at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. I've been a little delayed on some updates, but got some pretty cool stuff coming up, some breakthroughs.
As for me, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That's my social media handle. You can find all my social media work there, or just Google Mr. Babyman. You'll find all that stuff there. Facebook and Twitter, also Mr. Babyman. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown for us to publish on the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.